Maybe we need to draw up some more support, bring people in. A whole group of people used to come, have stopped coming. I don't know why. Maybe we need to make contact with them. I'm not quite sure what happened to the millers today. Also, I'm not quite sure, but...
Usually it's not related to the boss.
All right. It's a shame, because we're coming to the end. We're really... This is where it gets particularly, sort of fulfilling, because you... Sorry? Not today, next week.
Oh.
And we'll come up to Purim.
No.
In fact, I think we've got another... Next week is a shortened version because there's a guest rabbi coming. And then the week after we'll probably finish it, which is the week before Purim, which is really unbelievable timing. We spent a whole winter learning Megillat Esther, which I think is extremely encouraging and very, hopefully, very rewarding. I'm glad that we've managed to do this. We're coming to chapter 9, which is probably the most famous chapter of the whole story. Yeah, sure. And we'll go through the perek, we'll go through the chapter with some of the nuances, and I want to talk a little bit at the end about the celebration of the holiday. Right, the end of the day, Purim is a very strange holiday. For reasons that we all know, the kind of celebration, the fact that it runs over 2 days. I think we're looking at page 1259 at the bottom. There is an interesting There's a kind of build up to how the celebration takes place. There is also a very interesting background to the fact that the celebration was not universal at the beginning. Right, there is this suggestion, very interestingly, that in the first year that the miracle took after the miracle took place, there was a celebration, or rather, at that time there was a celebration in Shushan, but nowhere else. Right, and it took another year with encouragement from not only Mordechai but Esther. They had to write a joint letter. This is the reference at the end of this chapter to make the Jews realize that this is something that they need to celebrate. On a continual basis, really, forever and ever. On Sunday, please God, I'm talking at the Politz, Yom Rishon, on the famous rabbinic statement that if all the holidays are going to be cancelled in the future, Purim is still going to be around, which does create a certain amount of consternation in the minds of a lot of people to think that, you know, we won't have Pesach or we won't have Shavuos or whatever, but we'll still have Purim. And it really is a difficult statement because, in the end of the day, the other holidays are biblical. Purim is rabbinic, right? There's no discussion. Purim is a rabbinic holiday. So the reality of that statement and what it means, it needs a bit of investigation. So I'm saving that for, please God, on Sunday as a kind of pre-Purim presentation, which we'll do. Sorry? Yeah, if I get a chance, I'll go over a little bit of that as well because it's kind of interesting what that is all about. Okay, strange rabbinic statement that Purim remains, everything else goes away. How odd. All right, what we'll do, we'll start with chapter 9. We'll go through the famous story at the end. We'll leave chapter 10 for next week. Although it's only 3 psukim, it is very, very significant in a lot of other ways. And as I said, once we get through these psukim, there is a handout which I gave you, which I want to go through a little bit in order to discuss some of the nuances of the holiday, because there are a number of things which are really quite interesting. All right, so if you're with me, page 1259 at the bottom, Ubishneimos Achodesh Chodesh Adar. So we've come to the 12th month, the month of Adar, Shlosh Asayomba. Remember, that was the date that was sent out originally by the king saying, be ready to do whatever you have to do, and then Haman adds his interpretation to the original decree to kill the Jews. So it was Haman who added the interpretation, and Mordechai sent out a second letter, which said, on the contrary, it means that the Jews can kill their enemies. And as we said last week, there is a dilemma that the people holding these two letters really don't know what to do. Do you follow the first one, or do you follow the second one? You know, do you follow Haman's interpretation or Mordechai? So in this first pasuk, one of the commentaries called Megillat Starim says that is one of the basic miracles of Purim, that they actually followed the second letter and not the first. All right, because really they've got in their hands two letters, contradiction. One says the Jews can kill their enemies. The other one says the enemy of the Jew can kill the Jew. So what's going on? What do I do? Right, if I'm standing in one of the 127 countries, how do I behave? And the miracle was that when the Jews took this second letter and acted on it, everybody was unable, in terms of the Amalekim, the Amalekites that they were attacking, they were unable to fight back. Right, this is one of the incredible miracles of the story of Purim. And in a way, you know, it reminds me of you always come back to this, the stories from the Holocaust, particularly the Warsaw Ghetto. One of the incredible things at the Warsaw Ghetto, when you see the actual recreation of the events, was the fact that a tiny group, in comparison to the German army, which had conquered the whole of Europe by then, was able to stand up against the Germans for 6 weeks. Longer than the Polish army. The Polish army only survived 4 weeks. And the reality was that the Germans, I remember seeing a recreation of it a number of years ago. Hollywood did some sort of recreation of the Warsaw Ghetto events. And it showed that the Germans were really afraid of what the Jews were doing. And that in itself is very, very interesting. You know, there was a fear there. There was a tremendous sense of shock, and you know they were appalled that the Jew all of a sudden becomes a fighting machine against them. But more to the point, and this is really what's going on here with Purim. The fact is that when they stood up against the Nazis, though the Nazis eventually overcame them, there was no way they could win that battle. The small group of people, but the very fact that they stood for 6 weeks and managed to keep the Nazis away was an incredible, incredible achievement. And it's memorialized in Israel today in many places. There's a kibbutz, Lochamei Kitaot, there's a Yad Vashem. I mean, it really is significant that this event of Purim is replicated in Jewish history in all different ways. And one of them that I'm thinking of now, which to me is exactly what we're talking about here, are the events of 1942-43 in Warsaw. So again, look at this. It's verse 1. Shnei Moshe Chodesh Chodesh Adab, Shlosh Yom Bo, Sheegiyah Devar HaMelech V'Tato Le'asot, that all the decrees of the king had arrived. Be'yom HaSheh Sibro Oivei Yehudim Nishlot Bahem, the day on which the enemy of the Jews looked forward. Sibro means, the Saber means to look forward, to have this future task which they were looking forward to doing, lishlop bahem, to overcome the Jews, and it turned around. And of course, that is the big feature of the whole Megillah, the concept of a nahapoch, that what seems to be black is white, and what seems to be white is black. And again, that's another reason why people dress up, that they're not supposed to seem to be what they actually are. You know, you sort of cover over. It's all the symbolism of Purim. And that's the idea of a hidden miracle, that you don't see the hand of God, but underneath you know that God is conducting events and affairs of the world, even though you don't see it directly. We're not going to see the 10 plagues ever again, but we do understand that there is a Yad Hashem, there's a hand of God running the world. And this is all the tremendous lessons that we learn. But as I said, one of the big miracles is the fact that the people were able to stand up against their enemies, and the enemy, the Amalekites, that they had found living in all these different countries, they could do nothing about it. They absolutely had no response, and they were basically killed by the Jews living in whatever country they found themselves. Very, very amazing event. And it says, Pasuk Bet, Nikalu Yudim Barehem, all the Jews gathered in their cities, Bechol Medinot HaMelech HaShverosh. And we're getting overtures in this chapter of something extra. It's not just that the Jews managed to defend themselves, and it's not just that the Jews managed to overcome an enemy, but the fact is that we have the word in Pasuk Bet, Nikalu. We have something called Kehillah. We're used to this. In America and in the diaspora in general, we have tremendous kehilot. Okay, we have congregations. We have, again, this is the basis of Jewish life. It revolves around the shul and the congregation, and in many places more than one congregation, and all the delights of the Jewish community that we know. But the reality is, it's an incredible thing, and it's a structure which has gone with us through the ages. We are based outside Israel on kehilah. What is interesting is what's happening in Israel. Because in Israel, the concept of Kehillah is really not the same. Right? Yes?
I'd like to comment that when we see, like, you know, in Ozzy
Yeah.
Dispersed people, and then when it all of a sudden unified, the language is singular as one body, one soul, in Israel.
Correct.
I would think with the Purim story, we were so dispersed that Haman thought, okay, now I can get the Jews because they're so not.
Because they're so, right.
And we're so together now. So why wouldn't it be the singular Lashon, like Nikah?
Yeah, yeah, and it's a good question. You'll see later on that it does go from the plural to the singular, later on. All right? So it's a development. I think we have to understand that this was a major change for these people. They, again, back to what we said right at the beginning, they've come out of Israel. They've come into the exile. They have been dispersed through the whole world, basically. We know you find Jews everywhere today, Israelis particularly. You know, you go anywhere, you'll hear Hebrew. It's unbelievable. And the reality was that this idea of kehillah, of coming together as a congregation, is something which did not happen just overnight. Right, so initially, Nikalu Yudim, they had to gather together. Was there that tremendous sense of unity which is created? It's beginning. And I would argue by the end of this chapter, you'll see there's a Kri Kativ where it says V'kiblu, but it's written V'kibel. Because already the rabbis are aware through the writing of the Megillah and the way you change the word from singular to plural to singular, the reality is that that is the one of the incredible achievements of the Purim story. That community became an issue, became a real deal. And we, as I said, we take it for granted. You go to Israel. I lived in Israel for 8 years, and I lived in a neighborhood, Sanhedrin Mochevet, very, very from neighborhood. And the rabbi of the neighborhood, he was appointed, not by the neighborhood. They don't have elections, and they don't have contracts and all that business. The Misrad HaDatot, the Ministry of Religion, appoints the rabbi. So, for all intents and purposes, it was particularly one of those, it was considered one of those jobs which you had a certain amount of protection, you had a relationship with somebody. There was a certain Chavei Knesset, a member of the Knesset, it was all his relatives got these jobs. It was well known in the 80s, if you weren't related to a certain rabbi, forget about it, don't even apply. Unfortunately, Israel was like that. Today, a bit better, not quite as bad as that. But the reality was that the community, as a community, meaning the infrastructure in Israel is really done by the government, done by the country, social services. And all of this personal touch, which certainly the beginning was something that you experienced in the diaspora, in Israel just wasn't the same. You don't have the shul being the focus. The shul is the place to dump. And that's why you can have shuls in bomb shelters and, you know, wherever you find a place, you can gather people together, but that's not a kehillah. That's just a place of prayer. And the concept of kehillah, I would argue today, is changing in Israel because of the American Aliyah. The reality is that people are coming from the States and coming from other countries where kehillah is important. And I think the Israelis are beginning to get it. They're beginning to understand that having the rabbi is not just an appointment from the government, but he becomes the kind of organizer of social services from within the community that the government cannot supply so easily. You know, if you rely on the government, then you're really in trouble sometimes. You know, you're waiting forever. And this concept is beginning to take on. I know, for instance, in Beit Shemesh, where you've got a big American community, a lot of the shuls there are not just shuls, but they are communities. And they will appoint their own rabbi. They'll have a community rabbi and all this sort of thing, which we're used to, but in Israel, they're really not. They haven't had that concept. They really don't have it. And it's just interesting that the beginning of the process, from what I understand here, is with the Purim story. There's an exile from Israel, they go into the diaspora, they're spread all over the place, they don't have this sense of unity, they don't have this sense of togetherness, and present and common danger comes upon them, and all of a sudden, bam, they're completely overwhelmed by the situation, and they come together. And they begin to understand that Jews really do survive in a communal situation. And it's something we take for granted, right? And in fact, maybe we should be more appreciative. Well, we do appreciate the community. You know, we have all the various events during the year to appreciate it, but it's one of those things that we've all grown up with, we just haven't thought about it. Of course there's a shul, of course there is a gemach, of course there is a chevra kadisha, of course there is this, of course there's that. But all these things are really something very, very special, very unique. And it's just here you see the and again, this is spoken about, one of the real events of Purim is the creation of community. Is there someone at the door? I just come in. The woman's in the office, so we should be okay. So listen to that. We're going to follow this through a little bit more. So it's again, bet nikalu yudim barehem, They start gathering in their cities. Kol medinot ha-melech ha-shvirosh, lishloach yav v'akshei ra'atam, to literally take, stretch their hand against those who seek their evil. Hello? And v'ish lo'amad b'fnehem, nobody stood before them, ki nofal pachdam al-kol ha-amim. Their fear had come upon all of the nations. Kol ha-amim, on all the nations. We're just on page 1260. And we're just going through chapter 9. So listen to this, verse 3. Choserem adinot v'achashtar panim v'apachod, and all these impossible words that we have, you know, the officers and whatever. V'yoseh ha-melacha shel ha-melech menasim et yudim. And of course, this is the contrast. The same word was used with Haman, right? Haman mitnaseh, and here menasim, same word. The Jews are being elevated. Whether that's a choice or whether that's a reality, you know, I'm arguing here that it very well could be that, you know, they just were so afraid of what was going on that they treated the Jews in a way they hadn't been treated before, and that brings the people together. That also brought the people together. Ki nofal pachad Mordechai aleihem. And interesting, who are they really afraid of? Is Mordechai. Now that suggests that maybe it's not only just that they are elevating the Jewish population, but because of Mordechai and his position in the government, which can either be, as we've always argued, two possibilities, that he was, remember, he started off as a general in the army, and then he got promoted into the government, and his position is now seen to be very, very high up. But, as we know, we'll see next week, not all the people liked that. Not all the Jews liked it. Right, there was Ratzui l'Rov Echav. He only was appealing to majority, not to everybody. Very, very interesting. You know, the fact is, when you have a man in the palace or a man in the government or a man in Washington, it sometimes becomes a bit of a challenge. Is he going to be good for us, or is he not going to be good for us? That's one of the themes of Purim. Is Esther being in the palace good for the Jewish people? And Mordechai says to her, if you're not going to succeed, we'll have success from somewhere else, right? The fact is that we can't fail, because if we fail, we're done for, we're destroyed. So it's just interesting here, Pachad Mordechai, right? There is the theme, one of the themes of the Megillah, we've spoken about it again a number of times, is the theme of Pachad. There is this sense that there is a fear. There's a fear of situations. Mordechai becomes very powerful. Haman becomes very afraid of the Jews, even though he's pushing forward his crazy plans and whatever. This idea of pachad is something, again, which runs right through the Megillah and is expressed in all different ways. I guess a function of that world, right? When the strong man wins. So look, then we'll go on. Dalet. Ki gadol Mordechai beit ha-melech, because he's become so mighty in the house of the king. V'shama olech b'chol ha-medinot, reputation goes before him. Ki ha-ish Mordechai olech v'gadol, and ish is always used in the sense of an important person. He becomes stronger and stronger in terms of his importance, right? And this is very, very interesting. Posuk hei. At this point, the Jews arise against their enemies and they slaughter their enemies. And as we said at the beginning, there's no response, there's no reaction, there's no defense of the enemy, right? Which, according to tradition, the Targum says it here, that was all the Amalekites that they could identify in living in those places, presumably descendants, real descendants of Amalek. And as we said last week, Reb Soloveitchik writes about this in his book. It's not just the Amalekites today who are descended. We don't know who they are. Today, the anti-Semite becomes the Amalekite. Yes, question?
Does it say in Gila that they didn't fight back?
There's no suggestion that there was a response from the enemy. It's very strange. It's very strange. Yeah, well, it certainly says the Jews stood up and they were afraid. I think of the images from Holocaust, that one German soldier could herd hundreds of people. You know, if you've ever seen Schindler's List, you know what went on. One soldier was literally controlling hundreds of people, and he just had to be there, and people were just overwhelmed by that situation. So this is the factor, the fear factor, that when pacha, fear, is introduced, people just do not respond logically. They can be herded, they can be pushed around. It's a very scary world. This is the world that we're talking about here. And the suggestion is that when the Jews stood up against their enemies, no response whatsoever. They just went in and they killed them. All right, and again, I don't know whether it was as simple as that. I would imagine, you know, that there must have been some struggle and whatever. But the reality was that the fact that they could succeed on a level which we can't begin to imagine, you're given the numbers here, is incredible. And again, this is all part of the Purim celebration, which is, I would argue, we're not so comfortable with. We're not bloodthirsty people. We don't go around looking forward to killing people. This is what the world doesn't understand. When we get accused, as the Israeli army particularly gets accused of all these so-called war crimes, it just makes my blood boil, because the Israeli army doesn't do that. The Israeli army goes out of its way to avoid civilian casualties in a way that no other army in the world even remotely resembles it. And that includes the American army. You know, the Americans don't do it. The Americans would bomb the place and then go in and kill the enemy. Israel doesn't do that. Israel, when they go in and they unfortunately suffer the consequence. There's so many stories like that. It's one of those things that today the world is very skewed. We'll go back to the text. Pasuk Hey, Vayaku Yudim B'chol Aveihem, Makas Cherev, V'Hereg, V'Abdan. They basically killed them all with swords and destroyed them. Vayasu B'Soneihem, K'Ritzonam. And again, the turnaround. They wanted to do to us, so we now could do to them. Okay, and this was the allowance. And now we go into the numbers. Firstly, it started in Shushan, started in the capital. 500 men were killed, and I'm not going to read all the names of the sons of Haman. Just go to verse 10. Aseret b'nei Haman ben Amdata tzarei Yudim. So the rabbis asked, why did the 10 sons of Haman deserve to die? Haman was a bad guy. What about his kids were bad? All of them? Say the rabbis, yes. The reality is, Rashi says it, and I'll quote to you Rashi. Rashi says, Ra'iti b'seid olam, there is a very old commentary, a midrashic text, which says, Elu yud shekatvu sitna al Yudav Yushalayim, that these were the 10 sons of Haman, the same people who started writing letters preventing the Jews either to return to Jerusalem or to start rebuilding the second temple. Goes back to what we said at the beginning. Right, Cyrus makes a decree, he allows the Jews to return. There's 1 year where the Jews are given permission to go, and they don't go. And even the ones that do go, the Chalutzim, they start building the temple, but they can't finish it. And it takes another 65, 70 years before Ezra comes onto the scene in Israel, returns to Yerushalayim, and then the second temple is rebuilt. So what's happening during those 65, 70 years is that there are people who are stopping the project. And one of the main group of ringleaders stopping the project, the 10 sons of Haman. We also mentioned one of the midrashic traditions is that when the king was reading his book, when he couldn't sleep at night, he woke up and he started reading the book of Chronicles. What happened there? It seems that one of the sons of Haman was a scribe. And he was trying to erase, before the king would read it, he tried to erase all of the history about Mordechai. So what was happening, as quickly as he was erasing it, right, the Malach Gavriel, or whatever angel it was writing it back, you know, as if it was still there. The Midrash really goes to town on all of this stuff, which you can take it or leave it, whether you like that type of story, I don't know. But the reality is that these 10 sons of Haman were not innocent. They bought into the whole idea of what their father had set in motion, and consequently, from our point of view, they were equally as liable. Of course, also being descendants of Haman, they were by definition Amalekim, right? And if they're from Amalek, then that's the story. But they're given this special mention because of the fact that they were part of the problem. They caused the Jews a lot of trouble by not allowing the building project of the Second Temple to begin. And of course the irony is later on that it's Darius, a Persian emperor who actually allows it. The son of Esther, Nachashverosh. But that comes up later on. So listen to this. Again, verse 10. Aser b'nei Haman ben Amdata tzorea yudim haragu, they killed. We mentioned this last week, that the incredible praise of the Jewish people was that they didn't take a penny of the spoils. They didn't loot. And of course, you all know that in a situation like this, looting would be, unfortunately, one of the things that happens on a... We know around the world, this is a very difficult situation. looting goes on all the time in a lawless situation. And here, Am Yisrael were it's almost as if they took it upon themselves, right? The suggestion is they may have been able to do it halachically or whatever. They were able to go and take the property, but they refused. They did not want the king to suspect them of doing this for monetary reasons, which again is very, very amazing. There's elements of this story which are quite extraordinary. Even an assimilated Jewish community, like the Persian Jewish community at the time, had within it what we call the roots, right? The elements of Jewish character that we know. And one of them is clearly not to go and, you know, sort of feast yourself on the downfall of your enemies. This is one of our traditions. We don't rejoice that the Egyptians drown. We don't rejoice even on the destruction of the enemy on Purim. We rejoice on the fact that we were saved. I think that's an important thing just also to mention. These are all thoughts which are all coming together to highlight what the holiday is really about. Look at verse 11. Bayom ahu, b'mispar rugim b'shoshana bira lifnei hamelech. And the king starts getting the list of people who were killed. Right? On that day, on the 13th of Adar. Bayom ha'melech le'esther malkah. So he says to Esther b'shoshana bira, starts off in the capital, and of course, once it's established that it can be done in the capital, then everywhere else it becomes allowed. Hargo ayudim v'abed chamesh miot ish. The Jews have killed already 500 people, v'taser b'nei Haman, and the 10 sons of Haman as a kind of extra dimension. Bishah medinot ha'melech me'asu. And the king wants to know, what are they going to do? What have they done already in the other countries, the other 127 countries? Whatever you want, whatever you're asking, v'te'as will be done. So again, all of this means that the king is absolutely committed to what he promised to for Esther, and there is no going back. And of course, for Xerxes, this is a big deal. He's not one of those most reliable people. And as a consequence, Pasuk Yugimu Vatoma Este Mamelato, Yunatein Gam Machar, La Yudim Asher B'Shushan. This concept of Machar, we saw this already before. The idea that with Amalek, there's got to be a tomorrow. There's like an extended battle, symbolically. You don't just finish it off today. As with Yoshua, there was a concept that the battle went over Machar to tomorrow. If you look at the story there, we're going to read it in a few weeks' time. We read it on Purim, in fact. And this, again, is very significant that Esther says to the king, Machar, give for the Jews tomorrow, Asher b'shushan lasok kedat ayom, that they can do what they did today, carry on their struggle. They are at Ser b'nei Aman, Yitlu ala Eitz, and now the 10 sons of Haman who were killed should now be publicly hanged. All right, and that's what happened with the tree. Was very high, and they managed to hang the one underneath the other. There are illustrated Megillot that you can actually get hold of, very expensive, I imagine, by now, which have pictures of these types of things, including the 10 sons of Haman hanging from the tree, all from the same tree. Wow. Yudalat. Vayom ha-melech le'asot kevetanot in dat b'shutran. This, the king made a pronouncement, this is what should be done. Vetaser b'nei Haman talu, and the sons of Haman were hanged. Vayikalu ayudim, again, kihilah, the Jews gathered together. Asher b'shushan gam yom ha-basir, chodesh Adar, on the 14th of Adar, v'yargu b'shushan shalosh miyotish, another 300. So in Shushan, there was a total of 800 plus the 10 sons of Haman, 810. Ubabizal oshochet yadam, again, no spoils were taken. They were strictly there, as it were, to carry out the decree of killing the enemy, but not to benefit financially from the deal. Ted Zion, what about everywhere else? Ushah Yudim Asher b'medinot ha-melech nikhalu. Again, all of a sudden, the Jews are waking up. They've left Eretz Israel, and the concept of Kehillah has completely gone away from them. They are, they're dispersed. And of course, when Jews are not connected to each other, that's when assimilation kicks in. It's one of the first signs of an assimilated Jew is when he leaves the community. Famous, famous Jew in England in the 1800s, Benjamin Disraeli. Disraeli's father was a member of the Sephardic community in London. He was the gabbai of the shul, right? And that community had been there since 1656 when they moved to England. They came back from Amsterdam, and that they were, you know, descended from Spanish Jews. And in 1810 or whatever it was, Moses Disraeli had a big bust-up with the shul. And whatever, he just, I don't know, maybe he felt that they were not being transparent enough with the money. It was all about money. And as a consequence, imagine this, as a consequence, what Moses Disraeli did is that he left the shul and he converted to Christianity. Wow, what a statement that is. Unbelievable. Talk about machlokas. Wow. And the reality was, Disraeli, who was born Jewish, yeah, he was absolutely, was converted along with his father. And that's why he could become prime minister, because the rule, the unwritten rule, but certainly implied, was that no Jew could become prime minister in England. Never happened. So Disraeli, and when you look at the magazines of the day, and I've seen this, copies of these particularly satirical magazines, he was always known as the Jewish prime minister. Can never get away from it. Even though he wasn't Jewish, he claimed, you know, I'm Christian, I'm not Jewish, I go to church every week, he said. The reality was that, as far as they were concerned, he was the Jewish prime minister. Very interesting. Even though his father had had this situation. Quite amazing. And of course, what we're saying here is that Nikalu, the first sign of disconnect, is when you move away from the community. That's it. You make a statement that I'm no longer part of the Jewish community, I don't belong. And this is the danger today. There are 70% of American Jews, the estimate is, who do not belong to community. And that's why the levels of intermarriage here are through the roof. They're absolutely beyond belief. And that is very challenging. You can run things on 30% of the people who are still connected, but in certain countries, in the UK for instance, if you lose 70% of the majority, you really are not going to be able to run your communal infrastructure. Things like old age facilities and all these sort of things, you won't have the donors, they're gone. The Rothschilds, who used to be the big funders of Jewish events in England, have all intermarried, they're all gone. They've disconnected from the community. James Rothschild, I actually taught one of the boys. He was in a non-Jewish school and I was teaching there. And there were two brothers, right, who both of whom came to the Jewish class, I'm glad to say. It was like a Sunday morning. And they were there, but their future connection to any Jewishness was zero. Absolutely zero. Now, were they ever involved with the financial support of the community? To a certain extent, but very, very limited extent. The answer is yes, but not the way they were. You read about Rothschild in the 19th century, and you know that these were main contributors to Jewish life, not in the 21st century. And it's one of the realities of Nikalu. You move away from the community, you lose it. You lose that connection. It's really significant. And what's happening here, and one of the celebrations of Purim, is Kehillah. We're coming together as a community. And look what it says again, verse 16. Rusha'ayudim asher v'notam en nikalu v'amod al nafsham. They started to stand together, right? Reminding of all the demonstrations that we've seen over the years. People come together. V'nachmo v'hem v'arog v'sonehem. And they managed to kill those who hate them. Chamisha v'shivim alem. And they throw out a number which is so staggering. 75,000 anti-Semites were killed in one day. And again, no looting, nothing was taken in terms of their property. It's just a number which is just beyond belief. And Yud Zayin, B'yom Shlos Asa Chodesh Adar, V'noch Barbasa Yom, V'asot Yom Mishtev V'simcha. So, back to what happened in terms of the event in Shusha. In the 127 countries, it says that they did this on the 13th, and they rested, as it were, from the whole story on the 14th. That's why Purim is celebrated on the 14th. But in Shushan, they had an extra day. They did the 13th, and they did the 14th, and they only stopped the attack on the 15th. So that's why Shushan has an extra dimension of celebration, Shushan Purim, which is the 15th. Okay, and that's the way it works. There's an extra concept of Shushan Purim, which of course is the idea of Eretz Yisrael. You have. How does he convert to Christianity? It's one of those strange. I suppose he makes. I wonder. There is a movie at the moment which is on very limited distribution, and it's. I don't know if it's a real story. It's called The Song of Names. I don't know if you heard about this film. We're showing it at AMC over here. And the movie is about a protege coming out of Warsaw in 1939. A young boy, he was 13 years old. You heard about this film, right? And he stays in London and he's looked after by a non-Jewish family who make sure he has a bar mitzvah, and they really are unbelievable people. And when it comes to the his family's all killed. They had to go back to Poland and they had no visas to stay in England, and they're all killed. And this young man was in 1951 destined to give a concert of a lifetime. He was billed at the whatever concert hall, and he doesn't turn up. He doesn't go to the concert. He disappears. And they don't know what happened to him, and the guy who looked after him put thousands of pounds into this concert, and he lost all his money, and it's an unbelievable story. The story continues 30 years later. When this man turns up, there's a son of the guy who was looking after the young man, who became friends with the refugee. He's not Jewish, and he tries to find this violin player. He tries to find him, and he finds him in Crown Heights in New York. And of course, he's become Chabad. He's become a Lubavitcher, become very religious. And one of the, but I won't go into the whole story, that's as much I'm going to tell you, worth going to see the movie. But one of the scenes of the film is when this young man at the end of the war is so distraught about what he's heard about his family, he goes into the shul and he says, he brings his friend with him and he says, I now announce that I no longer belong to the tribe of Israel. He makes that announcement in a synagogue. Now it could be that that is based on reality, what somebody like Moses Disraeli would have done. Stood in the shul and publicly disowned his allegiance to the Jewish community. It's pretty desperate. You read that, you wonder what must have been going on in the community to make him do that, to become Christian. I mean, is wow. And what happens? Yeah, we've go into that side of things. Yeah, you're always going to stay a Jew. You're never going to lose it. Right? Even though you convert, you're born Jewish, you're always Jewish as far as we're concerned. So Disraeli, by our definition, was always Jewish and never ever stopped that. You know, and apparently he was a good orator. You know, he really, he was in power in the government. I think a lot of good stories about him. A lot of good stories about him. All right, again, very interesting sort of historical side point here. Pasuk Yudchet, listen to this, verse 18. Vayudim asher b'shushan. Interesting that Yudim is written with two yuds. So again, maybe this is a reference to the fact that the Jews are becoming more godly. Shem Hashem is now emphasized in the word Yehudim, right? All these nuances of the lettering here. Asher b'shushan, nikalu, again, kila. This is the key word in the whole chapter. Bishlosh asabob, abos abob, noah, b'chamish asabob. They rested on the 15th. V'yasata yom mishteh v'simcha. It was a day of mishteh, of celebration, v'simcha, and joy. Now, bear in mind that phrase because we're going to have it again, but we're going to repeat it in a couple of verses. Yutet. Okay, therefore it says, Ayudim aprazim, hayoshvim barea prazot, the Jews outside the walled cities to commemorate the events of what happened outside Shushan, Osim et yom ha'baraseh chodesh Adar, the 14th of Adar, Simcha u'mishte. Note, it's reversed. In the previous verse, it was Mishter followed by Simcha. The initial celebration followed by the joy, the relief, as it were, of survival. Now it's that was the beginning. Now it's Simcha. Afterwards, it's going to be rejoicing at the concept of the holiday, followed by Mishter, the actual sitting down and drinking and whatever we do. Right? The focus of the holiday initially was the sense of relief, which was celebrated by the drinking and the eating, and then the general overwhelming simcha of survival. But afterwards, it became simcha followed by mishteh. Right? Very similar, I would argue, to what happened in 1948. The initial sense of the fact that the state of Israel survived engendered. I mean, it's already 1947 when they announced in the United Nations, right? There was a tremendous sense of simcha. But there was not yet let's say there would be initially a sense of mishteh, but not in the sense of simcha. They knew there had to be a war. But once the war is over, you get simcha, that joy of finishing the war, followed by mishteh. You can then have Yom HaTzmaut celebration every year. Thank God, and we still have it to this very day. So again, this idea of the holiday, and I would argue the holiday is growing. Because what starts off, simcha, mishteh, v'yontav, mishloach, manot, ish tereyehu, sending food to each other. Now that doesn't necessarily have to do with the salvation. It's a social connection between people. And if you think about it, that's the Kehillah element which is being celebrated. How do we celebrate every year the fact that we became a Kehillah? By sending each other presents. And I just have to get it off my chest. I always talk about this. The Chag HaPurim is not Chag HaPashkas. I think people have lost their dimension over here. The Candyland holiday that it's become is really quite scary. I was in Lakewood last week already. The Shlach Manot are out of control. And the reality is, the mitzvah is the way it's performed, essentially, in Yerushalayim. If you're in Jerusalem, what you see on Purim, and I saw this in Meir Shearim every year, was food. People will be taking cooked meals to other people who did not have food for the Suda. And you saw it, and it was beautiful to see. People were literally, from running around the kids, the adults, whatever, on Purim, taking cooked food to each other. In our world, it's become Chag HaPashkas. And that's very nice for Mr. Pashkas, don't get me wrong. I don't know the man, I don't know who he is. But the reality is, what we've turned it into is really a bit sad. Apart from the fact that it's really bad for you to have all these candies. But, you know, it's just, I don't know. I don't know what's happened there. It's very strange. And you can see, Mishlach Manot Ish L'Re'ehu, that we have to send gifts to each other, but in order to make sure that there will be Mishta, that there will be something to eat and something to drink and something we can over which we can celebrate. And that's really the essence of the holiday. And Pasukha, Vayichtov Mordechai et Adavrim Ha'Eila, the initial a command of Purim was sent out by Mordechai, not Esther, interestingly. And one suspects that maybe the Jewish world was not ready for Esther to put her name to these things, or maybe Esther couldn't because of her position as queen of Persia. I don't know. Vayishlach Sfarim Kol Yudim, he sent out these letters to all the Jews, Shebechom Linot, Amelech HaShveirosh, in all the 127 countries, Hakrovim Varachokim, far and wide or near, depending where they were. L'kayem aleihem liyot osim et yom ha'ba'asa yom l'chodesh Adar. They have to celebrate the 14th of Adar. Ved yom chamisha asar bo yom b'chol shana v'shana on the 15th. And of course, the difference is that the 15th is based on the definition of Shushan, which is a walled city. So the rabbi said that if we make the holiday of the 15th of Adar on every walled city, we celebrate Purim on a different day to remember Shushan. But of course, what is the definition? It's not a walled city from the days of Shushan, it's a walled city from the days of Joshua. So this goes back to what we said again right at the beginning. Purim represented a disconnect from Eretz Yisrael. All of a sudden, the celebration of the holiday is beginning to bring us back to Eretz Yisrael. We are all of a sudden celebrating a holiday where the definition of the day is a walled city from the days of Yoshua. Very fascinating. And that's the focus of the story here, yeah.
1 year we were in Israel for a program, but we were in Haifa on the 14th, and we went to Yerushalayim.
You got double dose. Yeah, what I lived was more crazy, because what happened was, I lived in a place called Mavaseret Zion, just outside Yerushalayim. And the tradition was, and they'd asked Rav Orbach, what day do you keep Purim? The yeshiva opened up there a number of years before I got there. And Rav Orbach said, can you see Jerusalem from Mosera? The answer is yes. So 15th, period. The year after I got to the yeshiva, somebody in the community went to ask the Badats. Now, if you're going to ask the Badats after asking Rav Orbach, you're going to get a different answer. You know it's going to be different. And somebody came back and said, well, Rav, I think it was Rav Weiss at the time, head of the Badats, said, well, Purim there should be the 14th. So you had, in the same place, this is what upset me, half the people keeping one day and half the people keeping the other day. It was ridiculous. And this is where Purim gets a little bit strange, right? I understand the idea, making a memorial to the day which reminds us of Eretz Israel, but surely they would have seen that communities would eventually split over this. They would have this argument whether they are a walled city from the days of Joshua or not. And there are apparently four or five towns in Israel where they're not sure, so they do Purim on the 14th, and then they read the Megillah again on the 15th. Jerusalem is the only one for sure that had a wall from the days of Joshua. Right? But there may be other places, and with archaeological excavation, who knows? Let's say they find the walls of a town called Chatzor, famous in the Bible, Chatzor in the north. And they find the walls, right, and they dig them up, then who knows? Maybe you'll have to start keeping, if anyone lives in that neighborhood, keeping Purim on a different day. I mean, I just don't know how this is. Does this now become fixed, or is it, as they were, as one would say, an evolutionary process? I don't know. But the holiday is really interesting. The way it got, the idea was to celebrate community in different places, and of course it became, unfortunately, a way of splitting communities. And this again is one of the stories. There is a place in Europe, I think it's Prague, I think, where they also do an extra day. They read the Megillah on the 15th, because there's a suggestion, it was either Prague or Amsterdam, there was a suggestion that there was once upon a time a very old wall around the city. And it could be that London had that discussion, because the old city of London had a wall around it. So I don't know, but whether you can prove it goes back to biblical days is almost impossible. Right? Again, with archaeological evidence, maybe one can prove it. I don't know. We'll go on. Just want to finish the chapter. Oh, look at the time. Wow. But Kayomim Asher Nochabem Ayudim Eveihem. These were the days when the Jews rested from the enemy. V'achodesh Asher Nepachlem Yogon L'Simcha Me'eva L'Yontov L'Asot Totom Yimei Mishteh V'Simcha. Again, Mishteh V'Simcha. We're going back to describing the holiday in its essence, the joy of the drinking, etc., and the joy of completion and the fact that we survive. And it's developed again. Mishloach manot ish l're'ehu. We're now sending gifts, u'matanot levyonim, and special gifts to the poor. So you'll say to me, I'm supposed to do that anyway. Stuck up. I do stuck. No, Purim has got an extra dimension. That if we're bringing a community together, we've got to care for those who are not as fortunate as others in the community. This is a special focus of Purim, which I think, again, is very interesting. You can see here, as I'm suggesting, the key word of the chapter is Nikalu Kila, and the celebration of the holiday is becoming a celebration of communal proportions. And here's the Kibel, here's the singular, right? Verse 23. V'kibel ayudim, should have said v'kiblu. Now we've got to the point where ki'ish echad, they become one man, they become unified. Kibel ayudim et asher chelu lason. All of a sudden, they make this overall acceptance of what was going on. Et asher katav Mordechai aleihem, what Mordechai had written. Again, not mentioning Esther. Ki Haman ben Amdata egagi tzarek al yudim. The final description again of what happened. The Haman chashav al yudim l'adam. Thought about, made a plan to kill the Jews. V'ipil pur hu agoral, and he made the pur, which is the lottery, luhu mam labdam, to confuse and destroy them. U'beboal ifnei amelech amarim ha-sefer, and when Esther came to the king, she commanded through, it was commanded through the letter, yashuv machshavta ra'ah shechashav al yudim ha-rasho, that whatever he planned to do to the Jews ended up being done to him. He was killed. V'talu oto et banav al ha'etz, and they were hanged on the tree. Al kein karuli amim ha'ele purim, plural, we mentioned long time ago, right, beginning, that why is it called Purim if it's about a pur? Should be called Chagapur, right? Purim is a double expression. So the Alshich, one of the commentaries, says there were two lotteries going on. The one box was filled with the names of the months, and one box was filled with the days of the year, 354 days. And what Haman did is that he actually took a piece of paper from one box and from the second box, and if it didn't match up, it said day 300, but it said Nisan. Nisan only has 30 days, couldn't be day 300. So he waited till he got to the point where the date, the number, matched the month that he pulled out. And that was the Purim. There were two lotteries going on at the same time. Makes the whole lottery thing even more interesting. And that's why it's called Purim, plural. Hashem HaPur Al Kain. Because of this letter, umaru kacha magi aleim, what was done to them, etc., etc. Kimu v'kiblu ayudim, again the kiblu, but written kibel, because by this time the Jews have really got their act together. Aleim ve'alzaram, and it became a commitment for their future generation. Alkol anilvim aleim v'lo yavor, and it will not pass. That's the whole reference to the fact that Purim stays around forever. And of course, the question is, what does that really mean? Liot osim et shnei ayomim ha'ele, kichtavam v'kizmanam. The 2 days of Purim will be celebrated as is written and according to the time. B'chol shana v'shana. V'ayomim ha'ele niskarim v'nasim chodo v'do. It's done through every generation. Mishpacha, mishpacha. Family and family. And you'll say to me, of course it's family. No. This is the statement of community which is happening. Mishpacha u'mishpacha. Families are coming together, recognizing their Jewish identity. Medina, Medina, ve'ir, ve'ir, Jews in the countries, Jews in the cities. And that is the celebration of the holiday. Why it's such a communal celebration. The days of Purim will not go away. Some say it means the actual holiday, or some say the message of the holiday. But that's what I'm talking about on Sunday. And the memory will never fade. Now there's a double signature on the letter. Because what happened was, as we said, the first year after all of this information went out, the Jews kept Purim in Shushan, but not everywhere else. They didn't do Purim for the first year. And what happened was that they realized, Esther Mordechai, if it's not with the signature of the queen of the empire, then it could very well be Mordechai, because people were suspicious, as we said, they're not all excited about him, for a lot of reasons that, again, we'll talk about maybe next week. The reality is that they did not accept the binding nature of the holiday. So you had to have a new letter coming out with signed by Mordechai and Esther. And she signed it Queen Esther. That they have to fulfill Purim according to the second letter. And it says, we just finished the chapter, they sent it out to all 127 countries, words of peace and truth. To fulfill the Purim as was done by Mordechai and Esther, kasher kima nafsham azaram, as they accepted upon themselves, divrei samot v'zakatam, as they fasted and as they cried, so too do we celebrate the fact that they were redeemed and they survived. Ma'amar esteh kiyam meyipurim ma'ela v'nichtav v'sefer, and it was written down. And this is the source for the whole discussion that the rabbis have, Gemara Megillah, where Esther is challenged by the rabbinic fraternity. She wants Purim to be written down. And the rabbis turn around and say, it's actually on the paper I gave you. If you have a look on the paper, just very quickly, where is the, just one second, I think it's on side one. No, I'll save this paper for next week, because it really is very, very beautiful what he writes there. The basic context of what happened was that Esther goes to the rabbi, Gemara Megillah, page 6, or page 7, I think it's of Zion. And the rabbis say to Esther, we don't want the story to be written down. And Esther says, but, you know, you say in Yiddish, mekinzich obnar, right? You're fooling yourselves, because they know about it. They wrote it down. If the trouble is, they wrote it down according to their version of events and not according to our version of events. So Esther convinces the rabbinic fraternity to write it down. Now you look in the Gemara Baba Batra, I'm just going to comment on this because it's interesting. According to our tradition, according to the Megillah here, Esther Mordechai wrote down the Megillah. When you look at the Gemara Baba Batra, you'll see there that Gemara discusses who are the authors of all the biblical books. And it says Megillat Esther was written by, doesn't say Mordechai v'Esther. It says it written by the men of the great assembly, Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. So you'll say to me, wait a minute, make up your mind. Who wrote the book of Esther? Was it Mordechai and Esther, or was it the men of the great assembly? So the Brisker Rav, very famous Kiddushi Agriz, Revelvel Brisk, Soloveitchik, he says the following. He says that there are two elements to Megillat Esther. He says there's the actual writing of the story, the historical presentation of the book, and then there's the spiritual growth and the spiritual input into the whole story, the Ruach HaKodesh. And he argues that when Esther went and said to the rabbi she wants to write it down, they felt she can't write it down because she's not able to put in the spirituality which you find in the book of Shir HaShirim, which you find in the book of Tehillim. She's not on that level. She's a queen in the palace of Ahasuerus, for goodness sake. So they felt that this was not something that would be imbued with holiness, with spirituality. In the end, what happened was that the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the men of the great assembly, who were prophets, they were the last of the Nevi'im, they wrote it down, but they put into the story, they kept the text, but they imbued it with a spiritual dimension. So when we read the story, all of a sudden it becomes a holy book. And you'll see the Gemara has a whole discussion. Is the scroll different to a Torah scroll, or is it be treated like a Torah scroll? We don't. We hold it with our hands. The Torah scroll, we're not supposed to hold with our hands. So there are different laws for a Megillah as opposed to a regular Torah scroll. So it does have a certain lower sanctity, if that's the way to describe it. But on the other hand, it's one of our holy books, it's in the Bible, and we read it, and it's a mitzvah to read it twice on Purim. So says the Brisker Rav, he says that's the sanctity that was given by the men of the Great Assembly. They made it, they elevated it into a holy book. But if you'd left it to Mordechai and Esther, it would have remained a historical book. We do not indulge ourselves on history the way the world does. We are interested, we want to know, but we don't base our religion on historical books. That's the Rashi, the first Rashi in Torah. The Torah could have begun from Parshat Shemot, right? The exit of the Jewish people. Why have all of the stories in Parshat Bereshit? And Rashi says, because the Torah is not a book of history, it's a book of God's plan in the world and understanding the spirituality of the Avot, going through the connection to Eretz Israel. Everything about the Torah is a lot more than just a history book. And this is what we know. So Purim, by definition, became a book which was written down by Esther and Mordechai, the historical facts, but the actual spiritual contribution to the story, to the event, that was added by the men of the Great Assembly. It's very interesting. Right? So it's like a double creation, a book of Esther. So we saw today, we saw in the chapter here, so many elements. And the one which, I'm just going to look at this page I gave you next week. If you can hold on to it, or leave it sort of in a pile here, we'll come back to it next week. The whole question of community. How community developed from the story of Purim. And I guess we do, this is what we do. We do celebrate Purim in communal settings. This is where it really happens. And that's why it says one of the things about Purim, it should be as many people coming together, Barov Am Hadrat Melah, and all the rest of it, you know, all of these principles become applicable. Purim is a celebration of salvation. It's a celebration of the Jews overcoming an enemy, but more than that, it's the Jews becoming identified as Jews. And that today is about as relevant as it could possibly be. Looking at the Jewish world, which is so moving away from Jewish identity, it's a big challenge. And I think Purim is as important today, if not more so, than it ever was. Something to think about. I don't think this is easy. Yes, please. Mordechai was? According to some tradition, we were suggesting not so much. Yes, he could be one of the Great Assembly if you take on, the problem is that again there are conflicting midrashim, because one midrash suggests that that was his position, a man of the Sanhedrin. Another midrash that we've been following says he was a general in the Persian army. So decide, what was he, right? And therefore the answer is that you get, and this is very typical of midrash. Midrash is presenting a version of the events. So one rabbi saw it that Mordechai was the greatest Jew living in Persia at the time and was the Sanhedrin representative. That's why he knew the language of the conspirators, right? The other suggestion is that he knows the language of conspirators because he's one of the great civil servants in the palace of the king. Because he wouldn't be there otherwise. Why is he walking around in the palace of the king? If he's the rabbi, chief rabbi, he doesn't. That's not his place. His place is in the yeshiva, it's not in the palace of the king. So the suggestion is, because he's in the palace of the king, maybe he's not the great rabbinic figure at the beginning, but the great, like, civil servant, the great representative of the Jews. And of course, as he becomes more connected to the story, he becomes that representative par excellence. Is he, as the great religious figure, does he finish it off like that? Some say he does, and some say no. As I said, Ratzui l'Rovecha. There's a whole group of people that don't want to have anything to do with him. Now again, if he's the chief rabbi, why would they disassociate from him? He represents the religious life of the Jews. So again, the suggestion is that maybe the other point of view is that he's not the Sanhedrin person, but you know what? He's a great representative of the Jews from a secular point of view. And as the story goes on, he is growing together with Esther in their commitment to the Jewish community. And as I said, you know, we spoke about this, that the Mordechai that we always know and have known may be slightly different to the Mordechai that actually is in the story. right? And that was, I hope, one of the reasons why it was worthy to come and sort of hear this, because it gave a different presentation. Doesn't mean he's less important. You know what? It makes him more special. Because he's a Jew who may not necessarily have been committed at the beginning, but boy, is he committed by the end. And that's incredible. Balchu, incredible thing. And that makes Mordechai even more powerful and Esther more powerful. What we have to deal with next week, please God, I want to read a little bit of what I handed out to you today. We will look at chapter 10, and we will deal with what I call the aftermath. What happened next? Right? Like in one of those shows where they stopped the camera. What happened next? What happened to Esther? What happened to Mordechai? What happened to the Jews? What happened next is one of the incredible conclusions of the story. It's not to be found in Megillat Esther, but it's been found in, I think it's chapter 1 or 2 of Sefer Nehemiah. And for some of you, I hope it's not the first time you're opening the book of Nehemiah, but we'll have to wait and see. We're going to look at Sefer Nehemiah and see the aftermath of the story of Mordechai and Esther. It's very interesting. Okay, and there's even a holiday which is celebrated in Yerushalayim when the temple is dedicated for the second time. Believe it or not, the 16th of Adar. Not a coincidence. They had the 14th Purim, the 15th in Shushan, the 16th, where? Yerushalayim. That holiday doesn't exist anymore. But they had a holiday on the 16th of Adar. Very, very interesting. To be continued, everybody. Thank you for listening. Appreciate it. Thank you. Good day.